Today on The Grave Talks, Ghosts of the American Revolution, a conversation with Sam Beltrusis. The American Revolution was one of the darkest chapters in the history of a nation. Death, destruction, and the worst of human nature made themselves known all those years ago. But is the energy and emotion from that tragic time locked in history? Or do the same dark thoughts, fears, and anxieties remain today, not only in the living, but in the souls of the very people who once walked this earth in physical form all those years ago? Today, we hear about those spirits and listen to their words as we discuss the ghosts of the American Revolution. Obviously, there's a lot of books out there and a lot of research and talk about ghosts and stuff with the American Revolution. What was your interest point in this? What did you think you could bring to the table on this topic that others could not or have not? What angle did you want to take with launching this book?
Well, my purpose with writing Ghosts of the American Revolution is to kind of do it the way that I do my other books, which is approach it as someone who is clairvoyant. And not only am I a historian, I kind of view myself as a psychic time traveler, which fits perfectly with the Ghosts of the American Revolution. So I looked at the different locations with a lens of someone who knows the history, but also was really fascinated about talking to the spirits and communicating with the spirits along the way.
So was there any moment, I mean, what was it for you that made you go, you know, I want to do this topic. I want to look at this one specifically, because you've obviously focused on all different things from hotels and whatnot. But what was your driving idea? What was the kind of the moment that sparked you to go in that direction?
The moment that sparked my interest in the American Revolution had a lot to do with the mob associated with the Salem witch trials. And I know that's kind of a weird comparison, but I really feel like what fueled the American Revolution was the same mob violence that fueled the Salem witch trials of 1692. So I felt like there was a parallel there. I also felt compelled to talk to the spirits associated with the loyalists, the other side, the bad guys. And I got a lot of emotion from the loyalists, like the Oliver House spirits, where Sally Hutchinson, she wanted to communicate with me. So I wanted to do something that was not only focused on the patriots in America, but also focusing on the other side as well.
So this is not a book where we're just talking about recounting history. This is you going in, having conversations, and bringing essentially new dialogue to the table with people who have long since been deceased.
Absolutely. The purpose or the goal of Ghosts of the American Revolution was really to kind of focus on the other side. We do have some famous people featured in the book, like George Washington, but it's, I would say, like the darker side of George Washington. You know, talk to other players like his mother, Mary Washington. And I did do the Ben Franklin chasing his spirit in Philadelphia. But what I uncovered in Philadelphia with Ben Franklin was hilarious. I mean, he has a potty mouth, and he's a potty mouth in the afterlife.
So tell me about how you began to do research for the book and how you began to put it together. What were some of your first steps in going down this journey?
So for me, that living in Boston, I have access to sort of the beginnings of the American Revolution. So I wanted to focus on like the beginnings when it was kind of crazy. Like they wanted to no taxation without representation. But Boston was the hub of the beginnings of the American Revolution. So I wanted to really focus on that. And because I live so close to the Battle of Bunker Hill, which was Breed's Hill, by the way, and really kind of dig into the misinformation and sort of the whitewashing of American history. And so Boston was my first approach. And then I went to New York City as well, because I lived in New York City for about 10 years. And I really wanted to focus on the history, the American Revolution history that was associated with New York City, which a lot of people don't know. New York was a major player during the American Revolution. And then I went to Philadelphia as well. So the goal was to go to locations that I knew very well and approach the spirits, not only the well-known spirits, but the ones that are often overlooked by the history books, and communicate with them.
So how did you go about doing that? Tell me about that process for you of going about and trying to communicate with the spirits who had passed on from that specific time.
For me personally, a lot of it is just going out in the field and retracing their steps. So for Ben Franklin, for example, I had an experience years ago when I was working as a tour guide in Boston, and what looked like Ben Franklin's ghost in the middle of the Boston Common. So that kind of inspired it. And then also I would go to, like, I would follow their footsteps. And if I encountered, like, at the locations that people have reported seeing, say, Ben Franklin's ghost or Mary Washington's ghost or Betsy Ross's ghost, and spend time there. And I wouldn't say I investigated, but as a clairvoyant, I can walk in a location and sometimes connect immediately with the energy at the location. Sometimes I don't. Sometimes it's like it's a mishit. But with these spirits, they were really wanting to talk, and they were wanting to set the record straight when it came to their role in the American Revolution.
So how do you go about this when you're trying to communicate and trying to get messages from that side? Are you communicating to them that, you know, hey, I'm working on this book. I want to hear your story. I want to hear it come from you. Or what is the process to get the information that you're looking for something like this?
It's different for every spirit that I communicate with. I view myself as a psychic time traveler, so I have the ability to, I can channel. I've channeled successfully for this book, where I'm literally taking on using myself as a vehicle to communicate with the spirits. I'm a psychometrist. A psychometrist is someone who could touch an artifact and basically back in time. Sometimes it's as simple as just like reaching out to them. I'm like, you know, hey, Ben Franklin, if you're here, let's talk, man. And that's kind of what happened with Ben Franklin. I literally went back in his footsteps to the locations where he's been spotted, and had an encounter outside of the Privy, which was his former home in Philadelphia. There's like a foundation where his house was, and I was like looking down. And I'm like, oh, wow, that's George Washington's old home. And there was the privy, which is the bathroom. I'm like, what's a privy? And I heard a voice behind me go, oh, well, that's where George Washington relieved himself. And I'm like, what? And I looked around, and there was nobody there. So I think it was Ben Franklin kind of like playing a joke on me, or just kind of having a potty mouth.
Well, when you have experiences like that, and you're in a setting of that nature, what is it like for you? I mean, try and describe it to someone who doesn't have those experiences. What are you hearing? What are you seeing as compared to what, you know, you would normally see when it's not a psychic type experience?
Yeah, for me, as someone that sort of like transports back in time in a lot of cases, for example, I did the anniversary of the Boston Massacre on the exact date, and it was right before COVID outbreak. So you can just kind of feel the energy in the air, and the reenactors were dressed up, and I felt like the spirit energy at the location was definitely stirred up by the reenactors. And so when I was there, I was kind of like, it was almost like I was transported literally back in time, not only with the people playing the characters or the people that were real people that died in the Boston Massacre, but I felt like I literally felt like I was going back 250 years. So it's like a That's So Raven moment for me. I will flash back, and I get snippets of information, and then I kind of come back to modern day, and then I have to piece together those snippets of information that I get, usually by touching something. Sometimes it's at being at the location where I'm able to do that time travel thing that I do. But it definitely, it's in my mind's eye a lot of times. And sometimes it's not. Sometimes I can like physically see the spirits. And the way I know that they're spirits and not people is I can't see their feet when I see them. So as a clairvoyant, it's a seer, but there's other senses that I use and other skills that I use as a psychic time traveler.
When you're getting information from the other side, is it more through observation when you're touching something and then you're kind of downloading that information and you're seeing it? Or is it like a conversation where you can literally go back and forth with the spirit on the other side?
It's a little bit of both. Sometimes I will flash back and it's like a replay. So I'm seeing the replay from 300 years ago. And sometimes it is a conversation. I had, this recurring dream of a African-American young man who was at the Oliver House. And I would dream this over and over again. And he was in spirit form when I was seeing him. And his conversation to me, we were like communicating back and forth. He's like, "You can see me?" And I'm like, "Yes, I can see you." And the fact that he's been overlooked historically for so many years and that I was able to see him gave him that closure that he wanted. He just wanted to know that he could be seen. And a lot of like women, a lot of marginalized communities were overlooked. It's always been the focus on the white, the white male, like the Paul Revere's, and even the loyal the British soldiers as well, the Redcoats, they've been overlooked too. So they have a lot of unfinished business that they wanted to communicate to me.
When you're doing that, and let's say it's a situation where you're almost going back in time, Scott Bakula-esque, quantum leaping it. I mean, obviously you're not going through and full on quantum leap, but when you're in that sort of a state, and you're seeing this other place in time. Is it a reflection of the image that was, or do you believe you are actually going back in time? Because I have a follow-up question to that, but I want to hear that answer first.
Tony, I think it actually, I'm not literally going back in time, but I see sort of like a videotape replay of what happened 250 years ago or 300 years ago. So I don't think I'm physically going back in time. I'm literally seeing what happened that many years ago, hundreds of years ago. So I'm not going back in time, but I'm seeing what happened 200 years ago.
And that makes sense, because what I was wondering was if you are in fact kind of going, traveling back in time and having some sort of interaction with a living character from that time, would you then be the ghost to them, being this kind of out of context character that somehow is showing up and they're somehow seeing or communicating with in their lives?
And that's a very good point. I mean, I'm like, how do I appear to them? Mm-hmm. And a lot of times they're not afraid of me, which I would think if I came in ghost form, they would be afraid of me. And a lot of it at times is their response to me is, "Can you see me?" And I'm like, "Yes, I can see you," which is the common conversation that I have with pretty much every spirit that I encounter. It's like, "Can you see me?" I'm like, "Yeah, I can see you."
What do you think it is when it comes to, and I know you cover a lot of things in here that are not just, very prominent figures, but I want to talk about that idea just for a moment of, when you talk about haunted locations, you talk about places that were very prolific to the life of whatever character it is that, or individual, I shouldn't say character, we're talking about real living people or were once real living people. When we're talking about those historical figures, are all of them there as ghosts in different locations, or can any historical figure be called up to try and have a communication with? Are only certain ones still around? It's an interesting thing, because anytime there's a location of prominence in history, you typically end up having the ghost story associated with the most prominent historical figure that existed that happened to have something to do with that property, which is a very kind of living humanistic way of looking at things. Like, there's been thousands of people who may have crossed through here, but of course the one who's still haunting is the one that everybody, knows about from their actions historically. Odds are that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense unless anyone can come through as a spirit.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that a lot of cases, a lot of the spirits that we see, the common, like Ben Franklin is a perfect example. I think because we talk about Ben Franklin so often, it's almost like it's created a tulpa or a thought form. So maybe what I'm communicating with it isn't necessarily his spirit, but maybe sort of like a tulpa or a thought form associated with his spirit. I'm not sure. I do know. That a lot of the spirits that from the American Revolution are residual in nature. Mm-hmm. And for those who don't know, a residual haunting, it's not like a disembodied soul. It's like the psychic imprint at a location that sort of psychically embedded itself into the property or the house or the book that I touch. So it's not, what I'm picking up on is different. It really depends. It's not necessarily intelligent where they can communicate back and forth. A lot of times I'm just seeing pictures of what happened years and years ago. So in that case, I would say that they're not disembodied souls that are stuck stuck here and are not in heaven. However, there are a lot of spirits with unfinished business that do continue to stick around and waiting for someone like me to help them undo their whatever they're sticking around for and kind of trying to figure out. It could be a lost child. It could be an unexpected death. Some of the spirits don't even know that they're dead. I do something that came up in the book. I interviewed Brian J. Cano, who I actually just recently did an investigation with at the Oliver House in Middleborough, Massachusetts. And he had a theory that I thought was really fascinating regarding residual hauntings. And that is, does a residual haunting have a shelf life? Is there an expiration date for these hauntings? And if you look at the stone tape theory, they would have an expiration date. The energy, like, why does it stick around for that for so long, for 300 years? And maybe it's because we keep giving that spirit or that residual haunting our energy to keep kind of for it to keep manifesting over and over and over again. So yeah, it really depends on the spirit, but I do think that the bigger names stick around longer, or their psychic imprints stick around longer because of the energy that we feed it.
And that's a real interesting way of looking at it. I had not thought of it that way in kind of the tulpa or thought form route. With that being said, if these manifestations of energy, just take Ben Franklin, for example, or any other historical figure that is rumored to haunt a specific area or people have stories of encountering them. If it is essentially something that's manifested because of our energy and the things that we're putting at it, and it's not really truly the spirit of Ben Franklin, but it's what we've created. Does that thought form or that tulpa or that energy mass that is now represented as Ben Franklin, or whoever is picking up on it is understanding it as Ben Franklin, is there, and I hate this term, but is there truth truly them? Or is it what we've made of it? Just as history has so many revisionists and we learn it one way or the other. For example, if one person learned some fact about Ben Franklin that historically is just complete BS, but that's what historically all these people and all this energy believes and is going through, is that thought form then going to reflect what the misinterpretation of history has pushed onto this individual? Or is it, do we have something there that is still a seed or some piece of Ben Franklin that is connected to that thought form or tulpa?
Yeah, my interaction with Ben Franklin specifically was kind of like what I thought it would be, in the sense that he was hilarious. I mean, mm-hmm. like he was a funny ghost. And they also report seeing Ben Franklin at where he's buried at the cemetery. And there have been reports of a golden butterfly. So he manifested as a butterfly to a psychic medium that visited the grave. So yeah, I mean, I do think that the spirits come through. And is it the same Ben Franklin that was around hundreds of years ago? Good question. I'm not sure. I do know, like, my interaction with him kind of fits in with what the history books tell me of Ben Franklin. Mm-hmm. But I'm also interested in the stuff that's not in the history books. And that's kind of like, you know, is it actual? Do I view that as facts? And I don't view my conversations with the spirit realm as fact. I just kind of replay what I pulled from them and kind of do like an interview, like I interview the ghosts, and whether or not they're telling the truth is up for the reader to decide.
And which is an interesting thing too, because when we look at spirits and ghosts, quite often people almost put properties onto them that are very not humanistic. But when you get down to actually having a conversation or hearing from them, someone can lie when they're alive. Someone can lie or make things up when they're dead as well. And if you're dead and, you know, this is one of the few opportunities that you may have to kind of have your voice heard, you're probably going to paint yourself in the best light as possible. That's a very humanistic thing to do.
There's a lot of that with the ghost of the American Revolution. I think that there's a lot of wanting to tell their story correctly, you know, and also wanting their legacy was a big concern for many people, like Betsy Ross and like Ben Franklin and, you know, and like Martha Washington, who what basically was the responsible for for George Washington's future as a president. So I do think that a lot of the people that we know about in the history books, they want their legacy to be preserved and for them to be remembered correctly. However, there's a dark side to everybody. And I think that dark side is something that I wanted to focus on. I wanted to present a full picture of these people and also the ones that are normally not featured and give them sort of like a multifaceted human description or take in my book. So I do think that they want to focus on the positive and not the negative. But there was a lot of bloodshed in the American Revolution. There was a lot of scrappiness, a lot of like almost about to give up. And, you know, someone like George Washington or Nathaniel Greene, who I'm related to, by the way, which is something I found out while writing this book.
Wow.
So I'm related to so many strange people, and they're all tied to the same person, Innocent Cornell. But yeah, I'm related to Lizzie Borden, related to Israel Putnam, who was one of the major generals during the American Revolution, which is another reason why I was inspired to write this book, because of that family connection. And also Nathaniel Greene, who was George Washington's right-hand man and often overlooked in the history books. Mm-hmm.
You said, you know, you wanted to kind of talk about and share some of the darker sides of some of these individuals. Let's talk about that. And I'll let you start with whoever you'd like, but jump into that with one of the individuals that you've communicated with and wrote about in the book. And we're surprised to kind of hear and learn about the darker side that we don't always hear about in popular history.
I think for me, like I always, the idea of enslaved people back in the time, the part that really kind of broke my heart was the voices of the enslaved people during the American Revolution. You have people that fought for their freedom, and they were promised freedom by winning the American Revolution or the War of Independence, and they were not given that freedom. So that dark side, like the idea that they brought in so many people of color to participate with the Patriots and also participate with the British Redcoats as well, that part was heartbreaking. Not to name names, but pretty much everybody that we know from the beginnings of America had slaves. Now George Washington was one of those who did have enslaved people, was, you know, more kind to the people that he worked with, the people of color that he worked with, but still they were not given their freedom when they fought valiantly during the Battle of Bunker Hill and all the major battles that were part of the American Revolution. So I did dedicate a chapter to the heroes of the American Revolution that were of color.
Sure. I mean, and that's the heartbreaking thing is, you know, in so many the characters, you know, they're in history books for this or for that. But the reality is, you know, obviously it was their things were obviously a different time and place. It doesn't excuse the behavior, but it is what it was at that point in time. And we sometimes don't get a chance to look and think of the character of the individual. We only hear or think about the big positives that get pointed out in the history books, not some of these well, really, that's a shitty thing to do, you know, that had to be happening, you know, obviously today, again, different mindset of many. It wouldn't be looked upon the same way, but at that point in time, very different, but still morally shitty to do.
Absolutely. And there was a lot of stuff that happened to the other side. So the Patriots were mob violence. Like that's how they approached the revolution. So you'll look at someone like Sally Hutchinson Oliver, who was the daughter of the governor of Massachusetts and was a loyalist, but by birth, she was terrorized by the Sons of Liberty, and having just gone to the Oliver House, which was her home, this woman had to hide when the Sons of Liberty came to burn down the house. Like, they burned down the larger house, so the smaller house still remains her house, but she had to flee multiple times getting away from the loyalists. And you'll see that from over and over again, that people that were kind of born into the other side, like born into the British side, were terrorized by the Sons of Liberty. And having done a channeling session at the Oliver House, there were other people that were terrorized along with Sally Hutchinson, including the staff. I mean, the people that worked for Sally Hutchinson. There were two women who were servants of the house, and they were brutalized by the Sons of Liberty when they came to ransack the property.
What goes on at that location today in terms of activity?
I will say that the Oliver House, the spirits are probably the most vocal that I've seen at any property in Massachusetts. Like, literally, like they will talk to you, and they have so much to talk about. And it has a lot to do with the staff, including Christy Parrish, who is the manager at the Oliver House, and the volunteer staff. But they really have encouraged the spirits to feel safe in their home and to communicate with the people that come and investigate. So I think that the spirits, it's many, many layers of history in that house. So it's not just the Revolutionary War history, but that sort of created an aura of disaster from at the property. So you'll see generations of spirits inhabiting that house. But the main focus really is the Revolutionary War. You can just feel it. You get transported back in time when you walk in. It's just the spirits from 1775, 1776 are still there.
When you go in and you're doing a channeling session and you're trying to communicate in some way, shape, or form, how do you go about that? Is it making a request? I've heard different theories and different methods that different people use as far as how they do it. Some talk about it almost like you're going to an operator on the other side and saying, "I can you help me get so-and-so? Or is it just speaking a name? Tell me, when you're specifically there and you want to try and communicate with a specific person or something on a specific topic, how do you do that? How do you get there, especially when there are so many different active spirits in one location?
Well, Tony, if you know my backstory, you and I talked before about a situation where I was channeling, and I didn't know I was channeling, and I ended up picking up an attachment. So I kind of learned trial by fire. Mm-hmm. I had the ability to channel without even knowing that I had that ability years ago that turned into a deadly attachment. So fast forward 5-6 years later, as someone who now knows he has the ability to channel, I approach it. I turn on and turn off. So I've learned how to use like the on and off switch when I communicate with spirit, and I try to turn it off as much as possible. So I'm charged when I do turn it on, and I literally imagine like an old vintage light switch where I'm turning it on, turning it off. So that's the step. When you're doing a seance, you have to do what is called lifting the veil. That is where you kind of you chant and you lift the veil. So it's a process of lifting the veil between the living and the dead. I will say this, the veil has thinned dramatically during the past year or so. And I believe it's related to COVID. I'm not sure why the veil is so thin, but it's so easy to lift the veil now versus say 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then I literally, I, I ask the good spirits to come in and the bad ones stay out unless I want to communicate with the bad spirits. And then whatever comes through, comes through. Sometimes I request specific people, but I kind of like let it, I let them decide who wants to communicate. And it's not always the big name. It's not always Sally Hutchinson or Ben Franklin or the ones that I want to communicate with. Sometimes it's other people that are desperate to tell their story, but are tied to the person that I'm trying to reach out to.
And that's where I want to take the next question. Who are some of the spirits and messages that you got while working on this project that you communicated with and about the American Revolution? What were some of those messages, and who were some of those people that would be lesser known? That wraps up part one of our conversation with Sam about the ghosts of the American Revolution. In part two, what are some of the spirits and messages that are lesser known who Sam has communicated with about the American Revolution? How did some spirits try to set the record straight through Sam? Did Sam get any messages or stories that were not necessarily historically documented about the American Revolution? And what were some of the most surprising things Sam learned when channeling for the American Revolution? Sam's book, Ghosts of the American Revolution, will be released in November of 2021, wherever books are sold. Until next time, for the Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.